You're listening to an encore performance of The Jim Engster Show, so please hold your calls.
This is Jim Engster. Coming today on the show, the great Buddy Guy from Lettsworth, Louisiana. He came to Baton Rouge early in life, spent some time working as a maintenance man at LSU, then went off to Chicago and became a rock and roll legend. He is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he has written about his remarkable life, and much of it details his rise from obscurity in Louisiana to worldwide fame living in Chicago. Buddy Guy will be with us. Also, Ralph Eubanks on the famous presidential campaign posters through the years. What will be the most memorable poster of 2012 as President Obama faces Governor Mitt Romney? We'll look back and talk about some of the great posters of yesteryear. But first, the news on 89.3 WRKF.
You're listening to an encore performance of The Jim Engster Show, so please hold your calls.
This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. The presidential election for 2012 is now just over 5 months away. And with us to talk about campaigns of today and yesteryear is Ralph Eubanks, the publishing director at the Library of Congress. And he is involved in a book that presents presidential campaign posters from years gone by. And what a comprehensive book this is, going back to races like the 1828 race, which I'm sure some members of our listening audience remember, in which Andrew Jackson defeated John Quincy Adams. Ralph Eubanks, good to hear your voice, and
good to be
congrats
here.
On a fine book. The book is Presidential Campaign Posters from the Library of Congress. What was the evolution of the campaign poster that has become such an interesting part of our culture?
Well, I think it really started with party politics, which kicked in the minute that George Washington decided not to run for a third term. But it really kicks off in 1828 for the most part, because that's the first election where men who didn't own property could vote. So the electorate had expanded quite a bit in that election. As a result, I think there was a real campaign that was going on. I think a campaign as we think of it today.
Now, I mentioned that 1828 race. That's where you start. Andrew Jackson, as we know in Louisiana, the hero of the Battle of New Orleans, he was the seventh American president. Posters, I guess, from George Washington through John Quincy Adams probably were not an intricate part of the campaign in those days.
No, they were not. And it really began with Andrew Jackson, who I find to be a fascinating historical figure, because even though he's the hero of the Battle of New Orleans, there was a great deal of negative campaigning going on against Andrew Jackson in that campaign, you know, largely pointing him out to be maybe a war criminal, and this only a defender and protector and defender of what they said, beauty and booty. But he took that around, and that's booty in the 19th century sense, of course. But he took that and turned it around into something positive, basically made it a campaign slogan. He was called a jackass. He turned that around and made it a symbol of the Democratic Party. And yet, what I say is Andrew Jackson was a candidate who would not allow himself to be swift-voted.
It is interesting when we hear people say that campaigns today are much more hard-hitting than they used to be because of the electronic age and the 24-hour news cycle. But it's apparent that running for president wasn't beanbag in 1828 or 1920 or 2004. It's always been a tough process.
It always has been, and I think you see a lot when you look at the posters, you know, over, you know, almost 200 years. You see a lot of themes that come out. You know, either we're going to take America back or we're going to move it forward. And those really come up back and forth. And a lot of the issues that we're confronting right now with respect to whether it's monetary policy or debt, they come up almost, you know, universally throughout the campaigns. I think what the other thing that I have found fascinating, we are talking a great deal about the economy in this campaign, but in all of the posters we had of the Great Depression, of those elections, the economy is never mentioned.
Never
which I find really fascinating. It was never really turned up in a poster that we had in our collection.
Well, I've gone through the book, and I recall seeing one. I'm trying to find it right now with an Adlai Stevenson poster, and in the race with Eisenhower, Eisenhower's poster said, "Vote for peace, vote for prosperity, vote for Ike." And Stevenson's, "Which party or which will be safer for you? The party of Hoover, bread lines, homeless, and banks closed, or the party of Roosevelt, higher wages, better homes, and Social Security?" So that's probably the closest.
That is the closest. And I think keep in mind, this is 1952. At this point, there is enough distance from the Great Depression. You're talking about a post-World War II America, post-World War II prosperity, for the most part. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, they could invoke this party of Hoover, which, you know, was a little bit harder to do in the 30s than it was in the 50s. It was a little bit easier to use that as a target.
Now, one of my favorite campaigns, and I was only 10 at the time, but I recall it, 1968, and you've got the photos of Pat Paulson and posters for Dick Gregory, Nelson Rockefeller, and a guy named George Romney. That was quite a race, wasn't it?
You know, it was 1968, I mentioned it was an embarrassment of riches. We didn't even include half the posters that we had for that campaign because the issues were, I think, people felt very passionately about the issues at that time. There were a lot of incendiary issues going on, particularly with respect to Vietnam. So a lot came up. So what we tried to do in the selection of the posters was to capture exactly what was going on. So you had Pat Paulson on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour campaigning for president. You had Dick Gregory, you know, halfway seriously running for president. You had the tension between, on the Republican side, between Nelson Rockefeller, George Romney, and Richard Nixon. And on the Democratic side, you had Lyndon Johnson, who drops out of the race once he's beaten by Eugene McCarthy in New Hampshire, and then Bobby Kennedy getting into the race and then being assassinated. And so all of that really comes up in 68. So we're just trying to capture all of that in the posters that we included for that year.
And it's interesting that the three major candidates in the general election in 68 were perhaps not the ones that were most colorful, Richard Nixon, Hubert Humphrey, and George Wallace. Wallace was colorful, but in a sinister way. I think he would, if he were with us, he would acknowledge that his politics of 1968 were not one of the shining moments in American history, but he did carry Louisiana in the process. Now, what campaign posters, Ralph Eubanks, do you think reveal the most about the history of our country and the politics and the nature of campaigning?
I think a lot of them, particularly from the early 20th century and the late 19th century, do as well. A poster that I particularly like is the William McKinley poster, and that is, I think that's around 1900. And McKinley is running on the gold standard, prosperity at home, prestige abroad, commerce, civilization. So I guess it is 1896. And he's running against William Jennings Bryan. That poster says so much about, I mean, there's a lot going on in that poster, for one thing. But it also says a lot about what people are generally campaigning on, prosperity at home, prestige abroad. It's something that's continuing to come up in campaigns. And I think that's one that I particularly like. And you also see this transformation of the campaign poster that starts to happen around 1960, when television is much more a part of the campaign and slogans don't really turn up as much on posters as they did in 1896 or even in 1936.
Well, because of television, the candidates today are somewhat different. It's a cosmetic era, and we'll have two handsome men on the trail in 2012. What do you think we'll see from the posters representing Governor Romney and President Obama?
I'm not sure we're going to see as much from the posters in 2012 as we are going to have seen in 2008. I think that's the one thing there. I don't think that the campaigns are paying that much attention to the poster as a symbol of the message of the campaign as they are with their other campaign messaging.
Well, in 2008, one of the most prominent images of that campaign was a poster of the president, and it said hope. What a great campaign poster that was, whether you
and
supported
him or not. I think that really, that campaign poster does reflect what I think what's ideal about the campaign poster and what works. You have a slogan that's very simple and direct, first of all, which it did. It had hope. Then you have an idealized image of the candidate, and then it's colorful and attractive, and it has something that can really capture the imagination of the voter. And that's exactly what that poster did. And I would hope that the campaigns would do the same thing in this election, but I've also said in a lot of interviews that I've done for the book that I wish that the campaigns would actually come to the Library of Congress, look at our poster collection, look at what's worked over the years and what hasn't worked, and try to bring some of that similar messaging into the campaign this year, and perhaps spend a little bit less on television and other media advertising.
Ralph, what do you think are the most and the least convincing posters during campaigns of the past?
The most convincing poster is the one that I think is very effective, is the one, it's a James Montgomery flag poster for I Want UFDR Stay and Finish the Job for the 1944 election. Because it captures done by the same artist who did the Uncle Sam image. It's got FDR kind of with the same pose as Uncle Sam, and I think that worked very, very well. Now, the one that I think did not work as well, and this is something that typically happens a lot with campaigns, is where the candidate tries to surround himself with political greats of the past. And I think that's one that happened with Eugene Cass's when he ran for president. I guess it was, what year was that? I think it was 1832.
Well, let's turn the clock ahead to 1976. You've got this amazing poster, which I haven't seen in some time, with Jimmy Carter bearded, and the caption reads, J.C. can save America.
You know, that's a poster that I really love, and we in choosing the posters for 76, and I have to say this is where the editor's prerogative comes into play, is that was the first election that I voted in, and I just remember so much of the tension that was going on in that campaign, particularly on college campuses, about the choice between Ford and Carter. Everyone felt that Carter was being a bit sanctimonious, and that Ford was saying, you know, everything is going to be okay, it's going to be like happy days again. So what did we do? We pull out the poster that has Jimmy Carter kind of in a pose like Jesus, and then also Gerald Ford as the Fonz.
2004, George Bush against John Kerry, a close race in which Senator Kerry would have won had he carried Ohio, and it was a relatively close race in that state. Now, what a contrast. So you've got one poster with Bush Cheney 2004 saying, stay the course, and then another from John Kerry saying, one more day to a fresh start. The American people ultimately decided to stay the course.
And I think it's because the message in that poster was much stronger than John Kerry's message. The message was strong. The graphic sensibility of the poster, I mean, they had a strong graphic image, the W, which was just ubiquitous during that year. You couldn't go somewhere where there's campaigning going on without seeing some version of George Bush's W symbol. And you knew exactly who the poster was for. You got a sense of the message. And the message really, I think, seeped into the consciousness of American voters at the time. And that's, again, I think the Bush-Cheney campaign did a very good job of using the poster to connect with the voters.
Well, it's two centuries of incredible election art, 100 ready-to-frame campaign posters from the Library of Congress, and Ralph Eubanks has joined us today. Thank you so much for sharing your story and the American story about campaigns from 1828 to the present. Thanks, Ralph.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to an encore performance of The Jim Inkster Show, so please hold your calls.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're pleased to have one of the great legends of music with us. It all began in 1936 for Buddy Guy in Lettsworth, Louisiana. He's written about his life and career in Buddy Guy, When I Left Home, My Story. This is a sampling of the writing from the man who has graced us with his talents for so many decades. I follow the blues ever since I was a young child. Follow the blues from a plantation way out in the middle of nowhere to the knife and gun concrete jungle of Chicago. The blues took my life and turned it upside down. Had me going places and doing things that, when I looked back, seemed crazy. The blues turned me wild. They brought out something in me that I didn't know was there. So here I am, a 75-year-old man sitting on a bar stool in a blues club trying to figure out exactly how I got here. Any way you look at it, it's a hell of a story. Good morning, Buddy Guy. You were 13 years old when you heard John Lee Hooker's Boogie Chillin' in 1949. What happened at that point for the man from Lettsworth, Louisiana?
Well, first of all, I had probably once or twice a year, one guy had old phonograph. He used that to crank it up with the spring, and they was playing Arthur Crudup and Lightnin' Hopkins. And I was like, I don't know what this is, but it was just getting next to me, you know, and I would take rubber bands and try to stretch them. My parents were so poor up there, I didn't even know what a guitar was till it started. She would get this catalog from Sears Roebuck every year while she would order our clothes, because there was no clothing store or nothing out there. She didn't make our shirts and things with a thread and a needle. She'd had orders from the catalog. And by the way, you could order something from the catalog. If a shoe was a 9, then a 6, it was a 6. Now, if you get a different brand, you had to try it on before it fits. You never did have to send nothing back then. Like I said, a 9 was a 9, a 3 was a 3, a 4 was a 4. And that was with the good old days. But each and every time I be interviewed, I think about it. I feel like crying sometimes because at that age, I thought they was just cheating us out some as children. I wasn't aware that that's the best they could do, which was eat to live and live to eat.
Your family probably didn't have electricity in your early years, did they?
No, we didn't have electricity and we didn't have running water. I had someone laughing last night here, man. We used to have to drink out a creek called Moro Bayou. And if it got real, it never did go completely dry, but we used to have to knock the scum or the skim back and try to get clear water out there. And we didn't even boil it, man. I mean, you just had to do what you had to do. And we drank that water, and I have people laugh. I'm still here. Sometimes I think it was better than the water we get now from the tap, you know, because it's got a lot of crap in it. That water didn't have nothing in it. Well, it had the fishes, the turtles, and everything else in there, but we made it, and I don't know how they did it.
Well, your father bought you your first guitar. I'm told it cost $4.35. It changed your life.
Well, I think it was a little cheaper than that. I'm not sure what it was, but it was a guy, his mother, which is my grandmother, would if she was talking, if she was live now and talk to you for 20 minutes, she'd figure out that we related. And sometimes I look at it and I say, you could be right, because in the beginning of time, they tell me there was two people, Adam and Eve. So I guess she was looking that far back. But I think he paid less than $4 for that, and they would go get this guy every Christmas, and he'd go from house to house, and all. That's the only big holiday we had was Christmas. I ain't know nothing about no 4th of July. I didn't know they called it the Labor Day, but we were laboring every day, so we didn't know about the 4th of July and all these other holidays we have now. It was just Easter Sunday and Christmas. And they would go get him every Christmas and bring him by, and he would play the guitar, drink the gallon of wine, and one case of beer, and they'd go to the next house on a farm, which is miles and miles apart of houses. And at the end of the day, he would go to sleep drunk, and everybody, all the rest of the kids would be playing with their toys if they had one. But I would go get his guitar and try to figure out what he's doing, because he could play the Lonnie Johnson stuff and Arthur Crudup stuff. And I said, man, I don't want no toy. I just want to do this. Because back then, you couldn't say, if I learned how to play, I could see the world. It was just, you was like a sore thumb. You was just a guitar player. You know, and I would stay like that until B.B. King came along with Sweet Little Angel. And I teased him now. I said, man, I could afford a guitar until you made Sweet Little Angel. Then I had to buy my guitar like you do a car on time.
This is an incredible story. Deeply personal. The blues legend Buddy Guy, who's one of our own, that chronicles his journey from Lettsworth to Chicago and the blues revolution that followed. According to Eric Clapton, John Mayer, the late, great Stevie Ray Vaughan, Buddy Guy is the greatest blues guitarist of all time. And before we get more from Buddy on his story, let's hear the story he's told for decades with his music. Kevin Gallagher.
God knows the black cat had crossed my trail. I had a dream last night. God knows the black cat had crossed my trail. You know I don't want you to sweep me with no broom, 'cause I'm afraid I might go to jail. When my right hand itch, people, you know I'm getting money for sure. You know when my right hand itch,
Buddy Guy, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, class of 2005, winner of 6 Grammys and Billboard Magazine's Century Award, born in 1936 in rural Louisiana, before World War II, in the midst of the Great Depression. And in 1957, on the 25th day of September, you headed off to Chicago, guitar in hand. What prompted the move to the Windy City, Buddy Guy?
Well, I taught myself how to play a little John Lee Hooker, a little Jimmy Reed, a few Lightning Hopkins licks. And I was working at LSU there in Baton Rouge. And someone told me, say, and my mother had a stroke. I'm the oldest boy, and I had to become a man before I graduated from grade school. And she had that stroke that same year, and I had to go back and say, you the man now, buddy. You know, it's no more schooling for you. Got to help the family survive. And working at LSU, there, someone told me I could come to Chicago and make double the money or twice or three times the money in Chicago as I would in Louisiana. And I found out that the greats was here, the Muddy Waters, the Little Walters, the Sonny Boy. Oh, I could go on till next week if you want me to. And I said, well, hey, man, I could work every day and go watch them play at night, and maybe I could learn how to play right. And that was my idea of coming to Chicago. I didn't ever think I'd be calling, you'd be calling me, talking to me now, after I met all these greats and learned so much from them that I went to sleep, woke up, they was all gone, and left that on my shoulder.
Well, the rest has been a treasure to anybody who loves music, and Buddy Guy, earned his spurs right here in Louisiana, went off to Chicago in 1957, and became a legend.
You know a black cat I've crossed my dream.
Now, what were you doing at LSU, buddy?
They called me like a utility man. Even I went to work here after I found out I couldn't survive, and I never thought I never would have. My mother and them told me don't ever steal or take nothing from nobody. But I was called a utility man. I would. They had a service station on the campus. I would work there, and if they needed me to drive the truck or the tractor, I did all of that, you know. So I was just available for anything that they wanted me to do. The boss was always a certain part of the university, and it was trucks, cows, tractors, gas, washing cars, washing trucks, whatever, you know. And by the way, when I left there, I gave them the notice that I was going, and they made me sign a piece of paper and say, if you fail, you always can come back. Your job is open. And every time I come there now, the few people that still live and laugh and say your name is still on the list.
Well, it was a segregated campus in those years, and you were of college age when you were working there. How was that experience?
Well, you know, actually, to be honest with you, I think some black kids was going to that college when I left there, and it wasn't even talked about. The thing I learned, when you went to college, you was grown. They could go there if you could afford it. And it was 2, 3, 4, 5 black people going to that college, and they considered you as grown, and you knew where to get off the bus at, I think. And that's what that meant by that. But I was just another employee there.
Well, on September 25th, 1957, Buddy Guy leaves Baton Rouge and goes off to Chicago, and you write about it. In fact, one of the chapters is exactly that, the date that you left. I think of this date like my birthday, writes Buddy. Fact of the matter, it's my second birthday. It's when I was born again, born this time not to stay in Louisiana, but to leave Louisiana. My life before September 25, 1957 was one thing. My life after was something else. And you mentioned that all you had in your suitcase, a few clothes, a reel-to-reel tape with a song that you cut at WXOK.
Right.
And your Les Paul Gibson guitar.
That's true.
You had no heavy coat. And
nope.
As you note, and I'm quoting Buddy Guy, you say, in Chicago, winter is a bitch.
You never been here?
I've been there.
All right, because, you know, today as I speak to you, I got on a pair of corduroy pants, and this is June. Day before yesterday, it was 97 degrees. So this is Chicago, man, you know, and I could make you laugh. You know, I left there September 25th in 1957. At least I should have left in June or July so I could let the winter come in on me. I met all the birds, migrating birds, going where I left them. They go down every winter, and I come here. And to make the long story short, I thought, as a matter of fact, I had a friend that passed away not too long ago. We played together named Ray Fanillo. And he visited me one Christmas, and he said, I heard of cold, buddy, but I've been in a deep freezer. They don't get that cold as Chicago do.
Well, how did you crack the music scene? We're not talking about small time here. We're talking big time. Chicago then and now was a haven for many talented musicians. How did you get in the mix of the stars of the city?
Some of the greatest that I ever heard. Singers and guitar players, keyboards, drummers. What happened is everybody came here. Leonard Chess had made the Chess Records, a historical record company now. And when they got ready to record, they found out I could play that rhythm. And that's all I knew. I didn't have no record out. I was playing Muddy Waters, Little Walter, Sonny Boy and them. And they found out I could do that. And they said, if you want to play it right, Leonard Chess didn't give me a chance to go in there earlier. They said, if you want to play it right, go call Buddy. And I would go in the corner. And I know what, you know what MF mean. I don't want to say that on your radio show, but every jazz musician and blues musician was MF. So So they would call me in and say, the Wolf is doing a session. We've been here 2 days, and Leonard Chess would hum the rhythm and could nobody understand, especially some of the guitar players who was reading music. And I'd get out of my bed and go down, and I'd say, what do you want? And they'd say, boom, 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 or whatever they mum. I'd say, okay, let's go. And well, one record in particular by Howlin' Wolf is, I forget the name of it, but the lyrics, I should have quit you and went to Mexico. And I went there, and two takes we had, and Leonard came out and said, now, how can he do that? Can't he even read it right? And y'all got all these lead sheets and didn't hear what I'm talking about. So that's what helped me a lot to be playing the rhythm, but I didn't know people like Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck and all of them was picking out those little notes I was hitting every once in a while. And on next thing I know, I was being talked about. You know, and I guess that's why I'm here today, is to say I finally proved them I could play one or two pretty good notes.
Well, you dedicate the book to Muddy Waters. You say, in memory of Muddy, father to us all.
Yes. When I came here, I was going on my third day, hungry, that had run out of my last dime. And I walked in a famous blues called a blues club called 708 Club. That's the address of 708 East 47th Street. And a stranger grabbed me by my hand as a little 3-year-old and walked me in that club with my guitar because he had heard me play. I played for him. I was trying to get him to get me a hamburger. And he said, man, you ain't hungry. You can play the Jimmy Reed record like that or Bobby Bland's further on up the road. And Otis Ray, he talked to Otis in and caught me on the stage. I played two songs, and somebody called Muddy, which was living about six blocks away from the club. He got out of his bed to come hear me. And that was the beginning of me saying, if you stay here, Muddy, and you Muddy Waters, I think I should too.
Well, you start the book, and by the way, the man we're speaking with, Buddy Guy, is as proficient in writing his thoughts as he is in stating them. He says, I get up at break of dawn, been doing that my whole life. That's what happens when you grow up on the farm. Circumstances might change, but if you're a country boy like me, you still hear the rooster. My house is on the outskirts of town in the far suburbs of Chicago on 14 acres of land. Looking out the backyard, I see trees everywhere. Got a thing for trees. I like watching how the leaves turn color in the fall, how winter frosts over the branches, how little buds break out in spring and new leaves come to life in summer. The season's got a rhythm that connects me to the earth. First thing on my mind are beans. Thinking about going to the store to buy beans. Why beans, Buddy Guy?
Well, when I bought the house, I finally was blessed to be able to buy a home. And when the real estate lady was showing me the home and several other people looking at it, said, oh, man, this kind of house, you don't cook in it. I said, you better not sell it to me because I'm finna put some red beans and rice because, you know, Louisiana is noted for that red beans and rice, man. We was raised on that. That's, you know, that was 5 and 6 days a week my mom and them had. That's all we had, you know, with one little piece of pork in it. You know, we didn't have no refrigeration and stuff. They killed that pig on Christmas, and that was it, fresh pork until next Christmas. So beans is my beans greens. Boiled beans and greens is you know, I jump over a lake right now for some beans other than a choice steak. And I never lost that, man, you know. And I wrote a song called You Can Get Me Out of the Country, but You Never Get the Country Out of Me. Now, you got me. I got myself out of Louisiana, but you never got the Louisiana out of me.
We'll talk more with one of Louisiana's greats, Buddy Guy, after this brief time out on WRKF.
You're listening to an encore performance of The Jim Inkster Show, so please hold your calls.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Buddy Guy is our guest, and what a guest he is. And he is a man who's been on the music scene worldwide for over half a century, and he has taken his life and has written about it in Buddy Guy, When I Left Home, My Story, from DeCapo Press, and it is in bookstores now as we speak. And for those who We'll pick up a copy and read this book. You'll get not only a glimpse at the last half century of the life of Buddy Guy, and actually more than that. We go back 75 years, so we've got three-quarters of a century. But it not only follows his youth in Lettsworth and his path to greatness in Chicago, but there, of course, as we heard earlier, was a stop in Baton Rouge. And there is a chapter in it called The Rouge. Buddy says, I finished out eighth grade at McKinley High and had every intention of going on with my schooling. Then one day, Annie Mae came running in the house. She had just been out to Lettsworth. Her eyes were wet with tears. What happened, Buddy?
My mother had a stroke. That was the end of my school. Matter of fact, instead of eighth grade, it was ninth. I finished the grade school up in Lettsworth. That's high as they had up there. Wasn't no high school. And I had moved to Baton Rouge with her. She was single and trying to help me go to high school in Baton Rouge at McKinley. And that was the end of that.
You say
I'm the oldest boy. I had to go back and be a man and go back out there on the farm and help my dad and my other two little brothers to try to survive. Don't let nobody tell you a treadmill is good for you. Because I walk behind that mule and my dad from sunup to sundown, and I think that's more natural than a treadmill, and my daddy died at 56.
Well, before you got to LSU as a maintenance man, you write, my life in Baton Rouge began and ended with me working. I worked on a conveyor belt in a beer factory where the temperature had to be 110. The job was monotonous and taxed me 100 more times than working on the farm. On the farm, I was outside. I could hear the birds and see the animals. I dealt with live crops growing or dying according to the weather. I had the sky over my head, not a dirty ceiling in a factory that smelled like it hadn't been cleaned in a year. Farm work was hard, but I was seeing that farm work could feel free. The factory work felt like jail. That job didn't last long. Service station work was a little better. At least I was outside. I've always been good with cars, so dealing with them was okay, except during the dog days of summer. In those years, customers couldn't pump their own gas. The attendants did the pumping. That was easy, and so was checking the tires. But when it came to checking the battery and water, the second I popped open the hood of the car, the 96-degree day turned to 120. I did good not to pass out from the fumes. The average sale in those days, when gas cost 20 cents a gallon, was under a buck. The owner of the station also had been doing tow truck service. Before long, I knew every street and back alley in Baton Rouge. You remember where the gas station was, Buddy?
Yeah, on Capitol Avenue. And by the way, I drove the tow truck after I got here because ends didn't meet for me right away. You know, Muddy Waters wasn't making hundreds of thousands of dollars, nor was any blues player I know. And if you talk to B.B. King, I thought he was doing well, but he said he was just making from town to town when I left Baton Rouge. So that's that's the only knowledge I had. It was just in my mind. You know, B.B. King had a little bus, and he said he just was making it from Memphis to Nashville and the next town. He just made enough money to go from town to town. And we loved it so well, and I still do that. Whether if I had my life to live over, I would do it again.
Well, let's hear another sampling from the great musician, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, Buddy Guy. Buddy Guy playing that guitar like no other man can. I'm told that Jimi Hendrix actually went to a concert of yours one time with a recorder, and he was recording you so that Jimi Hendrix would know how to play the guitar. Is that apocryphal or is that a real story, Buddy Guy?
They got that on tape. We got that here. I think you can see that on, what is it called? It might be on Festival Express. But they got it here at the club, and if I can make my people look it up and get it to you if you want to see it. I didn't know who he was. That was my first time hitting New York because I'd been here in Chicago, and it's 1967. I was invited to play the Newport Jazz Festival, and they say, well, we'll bring it to New York to this club. And I said, well, I was told even before I left Baton Rouge and I got to Chicago, if you never play New York, you'll never make it. And I said, here's my chance to make it. So somebody whispered to him and said, that's Jimi Hendrix. I said, so what? Who is he? And he said, I just want to tape what you're doing. And somebody was taping him as he was doing that. And he sat in and jammed with me and told me he had a gig that night, but he found out I was coming to New York and he canceled.
Well, the book is quite a ride with Buddy Guy, and it is provocative in places. In fact, there's one chapter, and I think you know the one I'm talking about, Buddy, the wild little fill-in-the-blank from Louisiana.
Yeah. Yeah, they call you that. They call you that. They still do now. Even B.B. King, when Muddy and them was living, they would call me that, you know. Matter of fact, they would call you anything. The jazz and blues cats would call you anything, and finally, I started answering. I was calling myself kind of getting kind of angry when I first come in and was beginning to find know me. And I was like, that's not my name. You know, hey, MF, that's not my name. And all of a sudden, all the rest of them was answering, good morning, MF. And they said, hey, man, how you doing, MF? And I'm like saying, man. And 6 months later, I was saying, I'm okay. How are you, MF? And I learned the language. So that was a part of being a musician here in Chicago.
You're right that one night in late 1958, B.B. King showed up at the 708. What happened when B.B. King came to one of your performances?
Well, I didn't have no record out. And matter of fact, he had never been here before. And he finally got booked in Chicago. And I'm up on that stage. It was a very tall stage. And I knew him because I used to go watch him play at the Temple Roofs there. In Baton Rouge, I think that's off Government Street. I don't know if it's still there or not, because I told my brother I want to go by there when I come back there, which is pretty soon. And I knew him, and I saw that face. And I saw him and Muddy Waters sit down together with Little Walter. Little Walter's from Louisiana. And I said, oh, my God, I don't know what to play now, because I'm playing B.B. King, Sweet Little Angel, and several other pretty good big records he had out there. And I said, I don't know what to play now. That's B.B. And I just went into Jimmy Reed, and finally I hit one of his licks. And when I came off of my break, I tried to duck him, and he called me. And we've been friends ever since.
You've got another chapter, Buddy, called She's 19. Tell us about this.
Well, that's a record. Muddy Waters made a record by She's 19 Years Old. And I was always did love Muddy stuff, man. I even cut that on one of my albums, trying to, since he'd been passed, to try to keep his music alive because, you know, there's a very few stations play that kind of music anymore, you know. And I'm like saying, whenever I go to the stage, I'll play a Stevie lick, I'll play Muddy, I'll play a Guitar Slim, which is a famous guitar player, the first guitar player I ever saw with a 100-foot card there in Baton Rouge. And he was there in New Orleans playing at the Doudrop Inn with Fats Domino, the Ray Charles, and all of them was living there. So I just try to imitate Muddy a little bit, which you can't fulfill Muddy Waters' shoes. I don't care who you are, you know. When Muddy, if you was interviewing Muddy now like you're doing me, you'd be patting your feet. That's just how good he can sing, so far as I'm concerned.
You say that when I heard Muddy playing She's 19, he was 47. When I married Joan, Buddy writes, I was 23, she was 19. I'd actually met her a couple of years earlier when I first started living with Shorty. She was living in the same building with her mom, dad, and sister. She was a pretty girl with a sweet personality who gave me the love I was looking for.
Yep.
Tell us about Joan.
We got 6 children, and that's got to be love, and they're all grown. Matter of fact, half of them runs the club for me now. They're all grown and brought me grandbabies, and I still see her. We still get along all right, but being a musician, you can count the guys that went through life as a couple, and it worked, because you're never home. And some women will say, I'm tired of being by myself. But when I'm on the road, I just come in here 5 days ago from down in South America, and I'm alone if I'm not playing. I'm locked up in a room, and I would tell them, I'll say, I'm just like you. I'm alone, but this, you know, I've dedicated my life to this music, and it doesn't work. And some wives and girlfriends will tell you, it's me or the guitar. And that's what happened. Right now, she comes back and says, I'm glad you took the guitar.
There had to be a bit of temptation when you were on the road.
Of course that is, you know, but let me put it to you like this. I don't care how much temptation you have. There was a guy, I mean, that's rumors came out when the AIDS came out. So it was one guy went into Canada and spreaded it, and within, 5 years, he had spreaded it worldwide. That was an almighty guy, wasn't he? Man, if he could do that and spread it all over the world within 5 or 10 years. So I'm using that for an example. I don't care who you are and how much you play. The temptation is there, but you have to look out there and say, I'm only human. You know, I can't drink all day. I can't sleep all day. I can't walk all day. And you got to realize you're just another human being who's blessed with a talent. So I didn't take advantage of that. I met some friends, including Hendrix, several more, I won't call no names, Janis Joplin anyway. And they used to get high and tell me, say, man, you ain't going to never make it unless you join us. I say, every time I think about joining y'all, my mother had a broomstick and wasn't no broom straws on the end of it. She had that to hit me with if I didn't step out of line. So I'd always remember that. I didn't want have nothing that make me forget who I was before I learned how to play a guitar.
Well, you say in the book, Buddy, I've been in jail a bunch of times, but never for nothing I did.
Yes, I have. Never for nothing I did, but I had to go to jail to get some of the friends out. My late friend, Junior Weld, I think it was a sergeant, a lieutenant, come got me and said, you going to jail. I'm like saying, well, that's the first time I ever heard somebody going to jail and don't know what they did. And he put me in the back of the car, and when he got almost to the jail, he started laughing. He said, you got $250 in your pocket? And I'm thinking, well, I got to bond myself out. He said, no, it's not you, it's your friend, and I know you're going to get him out. And I started laughing because he still had to explain it to me. So when I give the $250 to get him out, I didn't know, you know, I'd never been to jail, you know, other than what I'm going to explain to you. And they gave me a pink slip. And the guy, what you call a turnkey, he had a big key, and he's swinging it around on his finger like a electric fan. And he got to the cell. Junior was half drunk sleep, and he says, is you got $10? I said, no, I just get the last $250 I had. He said, well, it take $10 for this key to turn. And Junior was asleep. He said, well, I'll open it up. You go wake him up and see he got $10 in his pocket. And when he opened the gate, I didn't know the gates automatically closed. And it started closing. I said, no, you wake him up, because if that lock, you're going to want 10 more to get me out. that's the only time I ever been in jail, sir.
You're right that by 1971, at age 35, in addition to my girls with Phyllis, I was the father of three other girls, Charlotte, Carlise, and Colleen, and three boys, George, Gregory, and Jeffrey, all with Joan. We were living in the two flat on the south side. Because I was on the road so much, the marriage was hurting bad. I provided, but not nearly in the style that Joan wanted. She wanted more, and I could understand that. The kids wanted more time with me, and I could understand that, too. When I got off the road, I was tired. When I played in the city, I didn't get home until the wee hours of the morning. Joan and the kids living in one world, I was in another. One incident, Buddy says, still burns into my brain. Happened after I had bought a cherry red Eldorado with a white canvas top. I looked at the caddy like a beautiful woman, curvy and sexy as hell. Couldn't wait to get in and drive. Everyone who knew me saw me riding in my Eldorado, proud as I could be. Well, one night, a month after I bought the car, I was up in the bed asleep when something told me to open my eyes. I woke up just in time to keep my wife from stabbing me with a letter opener. I got it away from her, no harm done, but of course, I had to know why she was crazy mad. Why was she crazy mad, Buddy Guy?
Because I had hit the Cadillac behind the house, and she didn't look. and she had spotted another guy had bald one just like mine, and he had the white lady all hugged up, driving slowly through Hyde Park, and somehow or another he lost her. And she just turned and gonna beat me home and thought it was me. And in the end, my oldest daughter, 3 days or 4 days later after that, she was still foaming at the mouth. And finally she went back down in Hyde Park, accidentally saw the same guy with the same woman, and come back and said, "Well, I'll be down. That wasn't you."
Well, I'm glad you and Joan are on good terms now.
I'm still waiting for the apologize. She never did. She laughs about it now, but she won't apologize.
Well, it's quite a life and a remarkable career, and it all began in Lettsworth by way of Baton Rouge on to Chicago, where the legend began and still lives for Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Buddy Guy. Thank you, Buddy.
Thank you for having me. And, you know, I'm coming out of way pretty soon. I've just been invited yesterday to probably come participate in something. They're going to honor me for being one of the guys, one of the 100 or 200 guys that ever left Louisiana that got kind of famous.
Well,
and I'll be in touch with you when I come. To just keep it. Let me know and let Anna know, and I'll come and see and say hi to you.
That sounds like a winner. Thank you, Buddy Guy.
Well, you do like the mayor. I come down and you know all of my two sisters and brothers retired chefs from LSU. And every time I go there, the mayor beats me to my sister's house, and we sit at the table and eat. And you're welcome. Next time when I come, I'll call you.
I'd love that. Thank you, Buddy.
Thank you so much, sir.
See you very much, sir. Your old homestead, your old stomping grounds, the great Buddy Guy. And thank you for listening, everybody. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Inkster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.